The Allegro, ballet music from Solomon II, or The Three Sultans, the music from Swedish composer Josef Martin Krauss. That was the Allegro featuring Concerto Köln and Saarbrücken. Support for Morning Classical Music is provided by those who listen and by Woodlawn, a 180-acre historic estate in Ellsworth, treasured for its historic house, gardens, and trails. Details at woodlawnmuseum.org.
When the day comes to an end, the music doesn't have to. Hi, I'm Sarah Willis. Join me Monday through Thursday evenings from 10 to 11 for In Tune Weeknights here on Maine Public Radio.
Join Sarah Willis, that's tonight, here on MPBN. And coming up at noon, it's Maine Calling, which you make possible. Thank you very much. And we thank for their support Patriot Subaru, providing sales, service, and accessories on new and pre-owned all-wheel drive Subarus on Route 1 in Saco. At 1 o'clock, it's Commonwealth Club of California, featuring Dominique Sisti, a principal author of a new report on mental illness from the University of Pennsylvania. He argues that comprehensive, accessible, and fully integrated community-based mental health care continues to be an unmet promise. That's followed at 2 by the Diane Rehm Show and at 3 by The World. Thanks for choosing WMEH Bangor, WMEA Portland, WMEP Camden, WMEM Presque Isle, WMED Calais, WMEW Waterville, WMEF Fort Kent, and thanks for listening at mpbn.net. The Maine Public Broadcasting Network was founded by the University of Maine System and Colby Bates and Bowdoin Colleges.
Child-free by choice. We live in a child-centric society today. New parents share every move their baby makes on social media, while others rearrange their lives around their children's soccer practices and school events. Yet at the same time, the percentage of families who are childless by choice is growing. Their reasons range from wanting to retain control over their own time to showing concern for the limited resources of our environment. Some prefer that the term child-free be used to describe their lifestyle as opposed to childless. I'm Keith Shortall, and today on the program we'll talk with a UMaine sociology professor who, along with her husband, has decided to be child-free, and why she's decided to talk and blog about the experience very publicly. We'll also hear from a social scientist who studies trends in American attitudes toward having children and not having them. And we'll explore how child-free differs from childless. First, this news.
From NPR News in Washington, I'm Lakshmi Singh. Tourists are reported to be among the casualties from today's carnage in the Thai capital. At least 16 people are confirmed dead from a reported bombing in central Bangkok, but that number could be much higher as authorities search through twisted metal and burned debris at the blast site, which, as Michael Sullivan reports, is located at a major intersection in the heart of the city.
The explosion occurred at the Rajprasong intersection in the central business district in front of the Erawan Shrine, a popular tourist destination. Police say several foreigners are among the injured. It's the same place where anti-government demonstrations were forcibly dispersed by the Thai military in 2010. TV footage from the scene shows fires burning and the charred remains of several motorcycles. It's not known what caused the explosion. The Thai capital has been fairly peaceful since the military deposed a democratically elected government in May 2014, after months of sometimes violent protest against that government. The military has pledged to return the country to democratic rule by later this year or 2016. For NPR News, I'm Michael Sullivan in Chiang Rai.
Residents of an eastern Indonesian village are telling police they saw a plane flying low before it crashed into a mountain yesterday. This hour, rescuers are trying to reach that aircraft, which was carrying 54 people, including several children. But the terrain's dangerous, making it uncertain how quickly the search team will be able to reach the site of the wreckage. Local authorities say the victims also include four postal workers who were carrying nearly $500,000 in government assistance for poor families affected by a spike in fuel prices. White House is launching a more than $13 million effort to specifically address heroin trafficking in several of the most vulnerable areas of this country. $5 million of that money will be directed to trafficking, distribution, and use of heroin. One of the world's wealthiest people, Jeff Bezos, is responding to a newspaper story depicting his company Amazon as a brutal place to work. NPR's Chris Arnold reports Bezos declined to be interviewed for the article itself.
It's unusual for tech titan Jeff Bezos to weigh in on a news story, but the New York Times paints a cutthroat portrait. It said Amazon employees are regularly reduced to tears by harsh criticism. They're told to snitch on each other to managers. And, quoting the Times, some workers who suffered from cancer, miscarriages, and other personal crises said they had been edged out rather than given time to recover. Bezos said that's not the Amazon that he knows. He said in a staff memo, the article claims, quote, our intentional approach is to create a soulless dystopian workplace. He said anybody working in a company like that would, quote, be crazy to stay. And he asked workers to report any incidents like those in the article directly to him. Chris Arnold, NPR News.
At last glance on Wall Street, Dow is up 32 points at 17,509, NASDAQ up 17 at 5,065, S&P 500 up 4 points. This is NPR News. Russia is hosting talks with Iran's foreign minister that were expected to focus on the implementation of the nuclear deal reached between the Islamic Republic and several world powers. They were also going to discuss the conflict in Syria. Republican presidential candidate Donald Trump wants to deny citizenship to babies born to immigrants who are living in the U.S. illegally. The celebrity real estate mogul also says if elected, he would rescind President Obama's executive orders on immigration. Straight Outta Compton rises straight to the top of the box office in the United States and Canada. NPR's Trina Williams reports moviegoers give the hip-hop saga a huge opening with $56.1 million in ticket sales, making it the best opening for a music biopic.
The movie tells the story of rap group N.W.A.'s rise to the top of the music charts with their hardcore lyrics about police harassment, economic disparities, and tough life in Los Angeles neighborhood Compton.
I got something to say.
Founding group members Ice Cube and Dr. Dre, as well as the widow of Ruthless Records founder and N.W.A.'s Eazy-E, are among the film's producers. Eazy-E died in 1995 of AIDS-related complications. Mission Impossible Rogue Nation drops to second place after holding the top spot for two consecutive weekends. The Man from U.N.C.L.E. debuts at number three. Trina Williams, NPR News.
U.S. stocks trading slightly higher. The Dow's up 36 points at 17,514. I'm Lakshmi Singh, NPR News.
Support for NPR comes from NPR stations. Other contributors include Farmers Insurance, out to educate everybody about common insurance gaps that can be costly so that no one falls victim to them again. Farmers Insurance, know the gaps. Learn more at farmers.com/innercircle.
With this look at Maine news, I'm Ed Morin. Nova Scotia officials say they plan to make a decision this week on whether to keep the Novastar ferry or switch to another company for the Portland to Yarmouth run. The province subsidizes the ferry service and has found the number of passengers to be disappointing. Nova Scotia's Transportation Minister, Jeff McClellan, says his department is examining books and revenues from the company before making a decision. Dennis Bailey, spokesman for Novastar Cruises, says that the number of U.S. passengers is up almost 30% compared to last year, while the number of Canadian passengers has dropped roughly the same amount.
We believe primarily that's due to the exchange rate. You know, Canadians lose about 30 cents on the dollar coming to America.
The state of Maine does not directly subsidize the service. State environmental officials say ground-level ozone concentrations are expected to reach unhealthy levels in the southwest coastal regions of the state today into tonight and move farther up the coast tomorrow. State Air Quality Director Mark Cohn.
This pollution event occurs when winds take pollutants from the states to the southwest of us, bring it out over the Gulf of Maine, and then sea breezes actually bring and impact those emissions and those high ozone levels into our coastal regions.
Cohn says Maine has not seen these unhealthy levels for almost 2 years. Moderate ozone levels are expected today for western interior and mid-coast Maine, along with the high elevations of Acadia National Park and the down east coast. In the weather, variably sunny in the north this afternoon, hazy, hot, and humid elsewhere, humid statewide. Highs 83 to 93, starlit skies tonight and very stuffy. Look for a lot of clouds in the north tomorrow elsewhere. Mostly sunny, hot, and humid. Some thunder possible in the north and mountains during the afternoon. With that look at Maine news and weather, I'm Ed Moore in Maine Calling Time, 12:08.
From the MPBN studios, I'm Keith Shortall, and this is Maine Calling. In today's child-centric society, people who decide not to have children are often faced with pointed questions from family members or friends or even strangers. Why not? Don't you think you'll change your mind? Or don't you like kids? And so on. But those who make the active choice to be childless have their reasons, and their numbers have been growing in recent years. With me in studio today is Amy Blackstone. She's a professor of sociology at the University of Maine, Orono. She and her husband run the blog We're Not Having a Baby. And Julia McQuillan is on the line with us from the University of Nebraska, Lincoln, where she's professor of the at the department and department chair of sociology. As always, we want to hear from you as well. Do you know someone who's chosen not to have children? Maybe you're one yourself. Our phone number is 800-399-3566. Again, that's 1-800-399-3566. Our email address is talk@mpbn.net. Tweet at Maine Calling or post to the Maine Calling Facebook page. Amy and Julia, welcome to Maine Calling.
Thank you very much. Happy to be here.
Yeah. Amy, I'm going to start with you with a question that might seem odd, given that we're devoting an entire show to this subject. But why do we care? Isn't this just sort of another in a list of personal choices that we all make? Why do you think it's important to bring it out into the public and talk about it?
That's a great question, and it's a question I think that the child-free ask themselves quite often. Why do so many people care about this choice? And I think you're right. On one level, it is a very personal decision. It's a decision that individuals and couples make for themselves privately, at the same time that it's a decision that can have public consequences. So some of those consequences include the stigma that child-free people face. So there are a number of negative stereotypes about child-free people. So we might want to talk about it and care about it because not all of those stereotypes are true. So talking about it is one way of thinking through where those stereotypes come from and whether or not they're true. Certainly, we have seen a declining birth rate in the U.S. In fact, since the 1970s, we've been below population replacement fertility rates. So I believe politicians care about this question.
It's a public policy issue.
Right, policy and families care. My sister cared that I wasn't providing cousins for her children. So I think on a number of levels, people care.
And we'll talk about some of the myths that you point to, sure, and some of the reasons and more of that. But terminology here, even before we came on air, we had a couple of emails, one questioning this term child-free that sounded kind of like, you know, fat-free, that children are a negative and, boy, we don't have to have them around us pestering us. Just the terminology, do you understand how that is perceived as somewhat loaded?
I do understand that, and you know, that's, I think that's a reasonable criticism. On the other hand, the term childless for a person who has made a conscious decision and the decision about their fertility that is right for them can feel a little negative. So the thing that I like about child-free as a social scientist is that it helps me distinguish between people who have made the conscious and explicit choice not to have children from people who I would refer to as childless, those who don't have children, but didn't make that choice. They wish to have children. And as somebody who studies this and who's a sociologist, there are important differences between those groups of people. So I think it's important to distinguish them. But I can appreciate that term might rub some people the wrong way.
Julia McQuillan, you follow trends in people's their habits, I guess, and in their attitudes towards having children. What can you tell us about this, if there is a trend, indeed, that's backed up by statistics with respect to child-free families by choice?
Sure. Well, one of the things I think is important, as Amy mentioned, that the childless are really different from the child-free. We have data from one nationally representative sample that shows that we focus mostly on women, although we could also do a similar study for men, that fewer women choose to be voluntarily child-free. But those that do are very different from those who have situational barriers where they might not have a partner or they might not feel they can afford to have a child or they might feel like it conflicts with their living situation or their partner wouldn't be a good parent. or those who have a biomedical barrier. There's more people in those situations than in the child-free, although there are a lot of people who are delaying, and it may be just that they feel social pressure not to claim that they don't want to have children. I think that the social context has changed enough where you can wait to have children because you have options around birth control, and so you can really think about it, whereas up until about 40 years ago, it was much harder to exercise that choice, so people didn't maybe even let themselves think about it.
What about the group of people who aren't consumed by making the decision or not making the decision? They're sort of in the middle. They're sort of, you know, well, maybe we could have kids. Maybe we can't. Maybe we shouldn't. I don't know. Let's just think about it. Think about it later.
We like to call them the okay either way, which is a highly technical term. But it's actually a term that came from people that we interviewed who we asked them. They were people that were having sex without birth control. They weren't getting pregnant. They looked like people who were infertile, but they weren't seeking help. And so we asked them, you know, what did you think of this? Why didn't you seek help? And they said, well, we were just okay either way. And after several people said this to us, we put it on a survey as an option for people to say, you know, at the time, are you trying to get pregnant? Are you trying not to get pregnant? Or are you okay either way? And 24% of women in the United States said they were okay either way, which is kind of an interesting counterbalance to this active choice, that there's some people that want to see what happens. We don't exactly know why. It could be that it's a very big decision and they're not sure. But there are a substantial proportion of women in the United States who are okay either way.
Okay either way. Sounds like a good bumper sticker.
It does.
Amy Blackstone.
But I mean, they're distinct from people who are choosing to be child-free and people who are experiencing their situation as childless, which is really interesting. Of all the women who don't have children, those are really different experiences.
Sure. Amy, in your case, you're child-free by choice, right?
And
this is your... Tell us, if you don't mind, sharing about how did this conversation go with your husband?
Sure.
Was it one day, or did it evolve over months? Or
it was not one day. It did evolve over months. My husband Lance and I actually got married at a pretty young age. We were 22 and 23, and at the time had no question about whether we would become parents one day, because that's what people did. I later learned that secretly Lance was hoping that maybe I wouldn't want to have children, but he didn't share that with me right away. And in our 20s, I thought that we were too young to have kids. At the time, I was in graduate school. It didn't seem like that was going to work for our lives. And so if people asked, my answer always was, well, we're too young right now. I used that answer until about my mid-30s, when I started to realize I'm probably not too young to have kids anymore. I'm now in my mid-40s. So then I started thinking about it more deeply than I had. Thinking there must be a reason that I keep saying I'm too young, that I don't feel like it's the time for me to do that, and began to realize I simply like my life as it is. I shared that with Lance. We talked through it. We decided, you know, that probably we had already implicitly decided in some ways years before, but made the explicit choice at about our mid-30s, and, you know, continued to talk about it. It's not like it's a one and done kind of thing. We have the conversation about it pretty regularly now, of course, because we also happen to have gone totally public about our choice, and we blog about it as well. So it's definitely a topic of conversation in our household, and was a series of conversations.
So as we said at the top, well, there's really where it just sort of ends. It's a couple, and they're consenting adults, and they make a decision, and no one gets hurt, and yet people do care. They seem to be interested in that decision and want to express to you, because you're so public about it, why they don't understand it or believe that you're deceiving yourself or will be disappointed later. They're trying to save you from yourself. All
right.
Of those things. Why is that?
Well, that's a great question. Maybe I hope somebody calling in can answer that question. So my research...
But
the things we hear. I have to say my research is focused on the child-free, so I haven't actually spoken with parents who are asking those questions, so I have less information about what their motivations are for asking them. But I can imagine That, you know, one concern people raise is this question about what are you going to do when you're older? Who will take care of you when you're old? There's a comedian by the name of Jen Kirkman who worked on the Chelsea Lately show, who wrote a book about her choice to be child-free, and she talks about the "you'll die alone" claim that people make all the time.
Well, this is why once upon a time people had 10 kids,
right,
so they could have people to work on the farm, right?
Right, yeah. Right. So, but what we hear from the child-free people that we've met through our experience blogging, and what I have heard from the, you know, 50-plus people that I've interviewed who've made the choice to be child-free, is that they are aware that they will age. They are aware that they need to make plans for aging. And most of them are doing that. So they are establishing connections throughout their communities. And there's some research to show that the social networks of people without children are a little bit more diverse and bigger than those of parents, which makes sense because parents are spending their time focused on rearing their children. While the child-free are able to nurture connections with people who are not children, who are available for support as they age.
So, as you said, I think at the top, your siblings pressuring you. often pressures will come from grandparents if they're alive, or from parents, saying, "I want grandkids," and that sort of thing. So there are pressures within the family as well, and there are also religious requirements. So I was talking to a colleague about Ratum et consummatum, which is the Catholic belief about the validity of the marriage has to include then being open to children. It's just part of the whole deal. So there are these societal pressures, especially around marriage, to have children as part of that. Are there any other? Were there any other? Is there this sort of boot camp mentality? Look, I went through this, and now you have to. You should too.
Sure, there is a little bit of that too, and you know, it's a shared experience that parents have that the child-free don't, you know, can't share with them. And so, I think there probably is some of that too, and a thing that comes up in our interviews and conversations with child-free people quite often is how making this choice does cause a shift in friendships for people. So as people become parents and other, you know, members of the friend group choose not to become parents, there can be, it can take more work to maintain a friendship. So certainly, you know, pressure might come from that too, wanting to have a shared experience with the people you care about.
And I know we don't have any psychiatrists on here, and I'm certainly not one myself, but I've always wondered when people are critical of other couples for making a choice in this case, whether they're really their issue is their own decision to have children and whether they did the right thing or what their own internal thinking is going on there. I know you're a sociologist and probably don't want to touch that.
Yeah, I'll let you make that comment, but I won't comment on that.
I already have. I'm sure the calls will come in now. Julia, does your work look at all into, I guess, kind of any of the what people cite as the pressures when they choose not to, or any work around that?
Yes, I look a little bit at what we call social messages to have children. And so we were curious if people who don't have children perceive others as wanting them to have children. So do they perceive pressure from their own parents? Do they perceive pressure from their partners? Do they have more or fewer friends that have kids? And again, the answer depends upon the reason why they don't have children. So we were actually a little surprised at first that the voluntarily child-free had the highest perception of social messages that they should have children. And it may be because they are more vocal about the reason why they don't have children. So people who are infertile or have biomedical barriers or who are delaying or have social pressures may experience fewer people giving them messages to have children. But they're also... there's other issues as well. So we're talking very generally, but there's variations. So maybe a woman who is on public assistance and doesn't have a job or doesn't have a partner, she might not be experiencing pressure to have a child. She might be actually criticized if she wanted to have a child. And so it can vary as well. We tend to have these assumptions about all women should have children, but in practice, we actually vary based on people's social situation or their social status.
Right. So this is actually going to sound horrible, but is there pressure For example, for here's Amy, who's a college professor and has a good life set up. Is there pressure to say, hey, you're exactly the kind of family that should be putting more children on the earth?
I can tell you that the voluntarily child-free tend to have more income, maybe because they don't have kids, so they can both be employed if they're in a partnership. They tend to be a little bit higher educated, not a lot higher educated. So they could experience that. I don't know for sure because we don't know actually. I didn't survey people about their attitudes towards the voluntary child-free. We interviewed the child-free about how they experienced it. But it's a good question, an open question.
It's kind of classist. But anyway, we're going to take a quick break. When we come back, your questions and comments around this subject is 1-800-399-3566, 1-800-399-3566. This is Maine Calling. We'll be right back.
You make Maine Calling possible, as does Casella. Committed to increasing recycling rates while reducing residential trash and landfill loads through zero-sort recycling. Casella, giving resources new life. And Maine Medical Center, getting people back to where they belong, home. Learn more at mainemedicalcenter.org.
Next time on The World, an old village in the hills of Jerusalem where narrow alleyways lead to fountains, churches, and charming old Arab mansions. One of them has become a small hotel where star-crossed lovers meet. Arabs, Christians, Jews, no questions asked, because this old mansion comes with a story of a forbidden marriage. The hotel and the story on The World.
Join us for The World this afternoon at 3 o'clock.
Caption, I leapt out of the closet. And 4 months later, my father killed himself by stepping in front of a truck.
On the next Fresh Air, we talk about the Tony Award-winning musical Fun Home with Alison Bechdel, who wrote the memoir it's based on, and with the show's songwriters. Join us. La, la, la,
la. Tune in tonight at 7 o'clock for Fresh Air here on MPBN Radio.
And welcome back. This is Maine Calling. I'm Keith Shortall. Today on the program, Childless by Choice, or Child-Free by Choice. There's a difference. With me in our studio, Amy Blackstone. She's a professor of sociology at UMaine-Orono. And Julie McQuillan joins us on the line from the University of Nebraska-Lincoln, where she is chair of the sociology department. We invite you to join this conversation. The call is 1-800-399-3566. Email talk at mpbn.net, tweet at Maine Calling, or post to the Maine Calling Facebook page. Amy, I'll get back to you on, I guess, some of the what you would describe as myths around how people perceive child-free couples and families. The biggies, I assume, are that you're child haters. You don't like kids, and that's really what it is.
Yep.
Talk about that.
Oh gosh, well that's a loaded one. yes, there is a stereotype that people who choose not to have children dislike children. And the reality is some people choose not to have children because they dislike children. One of the things that comes up pretty with some regularity in the interviews that I have done with child-free people, I always ask everyone at the end of an interview, what do you want people to know about you, about your choice? At least half of the people that I have interviewed have said at that final moment to share something they want everyone to know, I don't hate kids. I want people to know that. That doesn't represent all child-free people. Just as parents are a very diverse group, the child-free are a very diverse group too. But I think that's a common belief that people hold about all child-free people, which doesn't hold true for all child-free people.
They're not all W.C. Fields, for example.
Right. Yeah.
But the other one is that they're selfish, right? That their job, they'd rather do what they want to do than be bothered by raising children.
Right. And this is another one. I think with all of these stereotypes, it's more complicated than the simple claim. So the selfish claim, certainly, some of us are motivated to be child-free because we like our lives as they are, and we want to make choices about ways to spend our time that we wouldn't be able to make if we had children. Does that mean we're selfish? I'm not so sure. As presumably parents choose to have children because they want to have children. So in both cases, people are making choices about their lives and the way they've structured that they want to make. Just an anecdote from some research. There is some research that shows that the child-free the childless people who don't have children, including those who want them and those who don't, that they volunteer more in their communities than parents do. They spend more time volunteering. Probably good reason for that. Again, parents, child rearing is a pretty time intensive activity, so it makes sense that while they're doing that, they might not have as much time available for volunteering. But I like to provide that a bit of information for people who have concerns about this selfish thing.
And Julia McQuillan, what does research say about the real reasons that people choose to be child-free, that there's this perception that it's their career is more important, and that's the central focus? What does research find?
Well, I can't speak Amy can probably actually tell you a little bit more from her in-depth interviews. I can say in general, when we think about the importance of motherhood in women's lives, and this is something that hasn't been studied much because there's just an assumption that if you're a woman, motherhood's going to be important to you, which is why talking about the child-free is really important. But also just among women in general, and even women who are mothers, there's variation in the importance of motherhood in women's lives. And we found that in a nationally representative sample, women who said that career success was important to them actually had higher importance of motherhood. But women who said that leisure was important to them had significantly lower importance of motherhood. And leisure is rarely talked about. But I think that, bringing that into the equation is important, because if we only focus on career, well, a lot of people don't have careers. They maybe have a job that's a living, but it's not their whole life. They have other things in their life that's important. And so as Amy was talking about this perception that the child-free are selfish, well, maybe people who have children, that's in a way something that they do that's important and fulfilling in their lives. It's a choice, and it's something separate from what we think of as sort of this always a tension between career and children. Well, maybe it's leisure and children, if you don't see children as something enjoyable.
All right, let's go to the phones. We'll start with Beth in Portland. Hi, Beth.
Hi there.
Hi, go ahead, please.
Well, what I wanted to say was that I applaud people who are intentionally child-free, because I think that if they do give in to pressure from society or family, my feeling is that down the road they may become bitter, resentful, and that doesn't set up a good dynamic for effective and happy parents, and therefore effective and happy children. I just think that people who are making that choice to not have kids, they don't need to feel pressured to continue to populate, because as long as there are families like the Duggars who are putting so many children on the earth, there's not a need to feel like populations are going to decline because of that. So I don't think that piece of guilt needs to be there at all. But I'm just appreciative that they know themselves well enough to know that parenting is not for them, for whatever the reason is. And hopefully they don't feel the pressure to give in.
All right, Beth, thank you. Any comment?
That's a great point, and that's one that has come up in my in-depth interviews with child-free women and men, that children deserve to be wanted, and to pressure somebody who doesn't want them, it raises some questions about whether that's in the best interest of the potential child.
Yeah. Julia, we're talking a lot about mothers, and obviously so, but what does the research say about fathers' attitudes, I guess, toward the pressures or toward their feeling pressure to become fathers?
We actually did one paper where we looked also at the importance of fatherhood in men's lives. These were men that were in heterosexual relationships with women. So we had selected the women, and then we had talked to their partners. And the importance of fatherhood in men's lives, those scores were actually higher than the scores for the women. And so I think we tend to forget that. We haven't done a similar analysis. We hopefully will get to that, that looks at different kinds of situations for men who don't have children or do have children, or among the different kinds of reasons for not having children. But our analysis of the importance of fatherhood is that it tends to be quite high for men. And I think that's an important part of this conversation.
Yeah. Let's go to Frank in Brunswick. Hi, Frank.
Back in the 60s, there was a movement called ZPG, or Zero Population Growth. And our goals were primarily to save the planet by limiting the amount of people that are on the planet. And it's still a very valuable goal, given the billions that have appeared since then. And I didn't see any congruence between environmental goals that are population-related and what you've been discussing today. In fact, what you're mostly discussing today is it going to be inconvenient, this kind of thing. It's kind of a self-indulgent discussion. I was wondering maybe if you'd care to comment on that.
Yeah, Amy? Thank you for bringing that up. That is a pattern that has come through in the in-depth interviews that I've done with child-free women and men. It is not the most common reason cited for choosing not to have children, but it is among the most commonly cited reasons. So, yes, there is most definitely a segment of the child-free population that has made the choice primarily because they're concerned about overpopulation, about the environmental consequences of overpopulation.
Using resources.
Right, correct.
It is something that I think is interesting in terms of why people feel like they should tell other people to have children. I find that curious, and I do think we need more research on that, but I do think it's a good point to bring up.
All right, let's go to Anne in Wells. Hi, Anne.
Hello. Hi.
Hi.
I just wanted to say I'm supportive. I do have two children of my own. They are grown. I don't really like someone telling me what I should do, whether it's the church or it's a friend or whatever. I think you should be entitled to make your own decision, and it's not really anyone's business. And as far as, maybe I think it's losing touch with someone that has kids and you don't have any or you don't want any, your interests change. Someone that has had children or has babies, obviously they're into diapers and PTA meetings and those kinds of things where you're not, which is fine. I mean, there are other things that you can connect on or not. But I am a very strong advocate of your own choice, and that it's not the church's business or anyone else's, what you do with your life to make yourself happy while you're here on Earth.
Yeah,
so I say good for you.
All right, Anne, thank you. Amy, I also wanted to bring up here, maybe this is a good chance, that in addition to talking about this, blogging about this as an issue because you feel that clearly people want to talk about mm-hmm. this and might be helped by it, you also have kind of another ambition, I guess, which is to bring sociology, the science of sociology, kind of out of the hallowed halls of academe and connect directly to society. And this is one avenue to do that.
Right. Yeah, absolutely. So I don't know if movement is the right word, but there is an effort in sociology in the discipline and has been for a number of years to make sociology more public. To we study the kinds of things that people are really interested in. We study human behavior. So I think more and more sociologists are taking interest in having conversations outside of the walls of academia and talking about issues that matter to people and sharing findings that matter to people.
Just some emails. This is from Facebook. I'm 33 and do not plan to have children, and I've heard, oh, that's sad, and even, you're not a real woman unless you have children. Ow, wow. People automatically think it's a selfish choice, but it's financial. I know I can't afford kids, and I'm not going to burden society with that. Economics are also on the list, then, I guess.
Absolutely, they are. And there's a little bit of a gender difference. Men, and this is research that does not distinguish the child-free from the childless. So if you look at people who are not parents, men tend to cite economics, financial security, as being more important to that decision than women do. But it's certainly something that comes up in the process of making the decision.
All right, we'll go to Tom in Portland in a moment. But first, we're going to go to Tim. Hi, Tim.
Hi. I'm a summer resident here in Maine, and in the late 70s, I was living in Los Angeles and working for Planned Parenthood and developed a Deciding About Parenthood questionnaire and actually had a couple of workshops for couples trying to struggle with this. And my experience there was it was a kind of a hard sell. Maybe it was because of lack of publicity, but we didn't get a whole lot of people that are interested. And I have two questions. One is, I'm curious if either of your guests there have done research on what percentage of people and couples aren't either child-free or want to have kids but are kind of struggling with that, maybe because one partner wants to have kids and the other one doesn't, or maybe they're both undecided. And the second question is, I wonder if either of them have done any research with gay couples and if there's any difference in terms of lesbian couples and gay male couples.
Amy, I'll let you go first.
Sure. Okay. So I'm guessing Julia can probably better answer the first question. But in terms of the question about lesbian women and gay men, I do have not many, but I have a few gay men and lesbian women in my own sample of folks who I've conducted in-depth interviews with. And what's interesting is what I've heard from them is that as we begin to expand our notion of what counts as family, what are families, and become more aware that family is not limited to mom, dad, daughter, son, but that many of us create families that don't map onto that exact model, that they report getting a little bit more pressure than they did in the past. So because as we are expanding our notion of what counts as family, gay men and lesbian women who might not have otherwise been pressured to have children are now experiencing it in a way that particularly heterosexual women have for many years.
Mm. And Julia, the other part of the question was around couples, I guess, that are divided. You have one that really wants a child and the other does not. And Tim, I'm not sure, were you looking for numbers?
Percentages, or maybe they're both undecided, and they're both kind of struggling with that important decision.
Yeah.
You know, I think you bring up a couple of really important issues. So one thing is that I've actually done a little bit of work on sexual minority women, and we had in a very large survey of almost 5,000 women, we had 43 that self-identified as lesbian or in a same-sex relationship. And one of the things we found interesting is when we had a random sample instead of a voluntary sample, the voluntary samples tend to focus on lesbian women or sexual minority women who really want kids or really don't want kids. And what we found was that in this random sample, there was variation. So they're similar to your question. There were women who were not sure that they wanted to have kids, but less likely to be able to leave it up to chance. So they actually had to think about consciously, do I want to have kids or not? And what am I going to do to make that happen? Do I want to adopt? Do I want to foster? Do I want to have assisted reproductive technology? In terms of couples, that's an area that needs more work. Most of the work is from the late 80s and early 90s. I myself haven't analyzed our own data on differences in attitudes about do they want to have a child or not. It seems to be that there are some people that really know they want to have kids, some people that really know they don't. And then there are these people who are okay either way. We haven't looked at that as much with the men. So that's an area that we need to look at, and as a couple phenomenon. We have looked a little bit at among the infertile, and if they experience distress when they're in the same couple, it tends to be the person who self-identifies. So if in a heterosexual couple, if the man says that he has a problem, he tends to have more distress. If she says she has a problem, she tends to say she has more distress. If they both say they have a problem, they both tend to experience more distress. So to some degree, it's shared, and to some degree, it's an individual phenomenon.
All right, we're going to take another quick break, and when we come back, Tom in Portland, I will get to you. And the number to join the conversation, again, is 1-800-399-3566, 1-800-399-3566. This is Maine Calling. We'll be right back.
You make Maine Calling possible, as does Maine Media Workshops, offering 1- and 2-week workshops in film and photography for teens all summer long. MaineMedia.edu. And Dead River Company, with its commercial services division, committed to helping Maine businesses find the right energy solution. DeadRiver.com.
You want the best of both political worlds? Try running for president while being an active member of Congress.
So as long as they have excellent staffs, both in their district and in Washington, the overwhelming majority of their work can still get done, even if they're on the presidential campaign trail.
I'm Kai Rizdahl. Yeah, that's a pretty good setup. We'll tell you more about it next time on Marketplace from APN.
That's tonight at 6:30 here on MPBN Radio. And just after Maine Calling today at 1 o'clock in our Public Affairs Hour, the Commonwealth Club of California welcomes Dominic Sisti. He's the principal author of a new report on mental illness from the University of Pennsylvania. Sisti argues that comprehensive, accessible, and fully integrated community-based mental health care continues to be an unmet promise. That's coming up in just 20 minutes here on MPBN Radio.
Welcome back. I'm Keith Shortall. You're listening to Maine Calling. Today on the program, what issues come up when you choose to be childless? With me in our studio, Amy Blackstone. She's a professor of sociology at the University of Maine, Orono. Julia McQuillan is on the line with us from the University of Nebraska, Lincoln, where she is a sociology professor and department chair. Join the conversation. The number is 800-399-3566. That's 1-800-399-3566, as promised now to Tom in Portland. Hi, Tom.
Hello. Hopefully the cell phone is going to hold out here.
Sounds good.
Oh, good. I've enjoyed the discussion. That's fascinating. I have a question for your guest. I've heard a good amount of conversation of childless or child-free versus parenting couples. But I've not heard discussion of the choice of the number of children that a couple might have, and I'm curious as to whether their research shows that it is an extension of the same paradigm that they've been discussing that leads a couple to have one, such as my wife and myself, or a teen.
Yeah, 14. I know, 14. I did have a relative who had 14 children. But this does come up too. People want to weigh in. You know, well, one, they'll be spoiled. They'll be only child syndrome. Right. You can't have just two because then they'll be focused on each other. You really need three. Three's too many, et cetera.
Right. Yeah. I think there is a lot in common between the child free and particularly people who've chosen to have just one child. Lauren Sandler is a journalist who wrote an article in Time magazine about 2 years ago, the title of which was The Child-Free Choice. And she was examining the child-free choice, but she also happens to be the author of a book entitled One and Only. And she has done a lot of work studying what it's like to be the parent of an only child and the stigma that parents of only children face. And she learned that many of the same stereotypes apply. So you're selfish. You must not like kids enough if you don't have, more than one of them. What happens if that one child turns out not to take care of you when you're older? Don't you want more just in case? So, there are definitely some parallels between parents of onlys and the child-free.
Yeah. Julia, anything to add?
Just that there's some research that suggests there's a very strong norm in the United States, a two-child norm. And again, I think it's really interesting, this tension between sort of a public good and an individual choice. And people can disagree about what the public good is there, but there's a strong norm towards two. And I agree with Amy about the one child has some stigma as well. There was a recent article that was just published that Amy and I both read about people that have one child. This was a European study, and that experience can change their perception of whether or not to have another child as well. So that going through the experience of having a child may or may not meet your expectations and can shift what you think you will have. Over time, people tend to have fewer kids than they originally intended to have.
Hmm. So they start off with plans.
Most people start with the two. Most young people don't actually think about it that much until a survey researcher asks them, mm-hmm. How many kids do you think you're going to have? What would be ideal for you? A lot of people will say two. Those who say higher, a lot of times they call it a moving target. So the ideal number of children or your fertility intentions tends to be a moving target. It tends to be revised as you go along, especially if you start having children a little bit later than you originally intended and you wanted to have many.
All right, let's go to Michael in Swanville. Hello, Michael.
Hello there, Keith.
Is this the Michael in Swanville that I know? Yeah, sorry, go ahead.
Yes, well, my concern is that I think that the discussion of whether to be child-free, while it's a valid discussion to have, and I don't think that anybody's individual liberties are ever going to be constrained that they should be forced to have children. But it just seems to me like the debate itself or the subject of itself seems innately elitist. And I think that we have a situation where you don't have a right to have children in this country, in a sense, because you don't have a right to daycare. You don't have a right to paid leave from your workplace when you have a child. These things that are that most of the developed world has, which are considered substantial rights and fundamental rights of all people and of children, are ignored here. And instead of instead of giving service to the issue of what it takes to raise a child and whether that's a right, we're giving service to the notion of adopting a position to negate having children as being perfectly valid. And, well, like I said, I don't think anybody's individual liberties are constrained. I'm just concerned with the elitist tone of the debate.
And can I jump in
yes,
for just a second, Keith? Well, I think this is a really important topic, Michael. And there's a great article called Children as a Public Good by Nancy Fulbray, a feminist economist, who talked a lot about what would a world look like if we all took responsibility for the welfare of children and raising children and giving them what they needed. And I think you're right that we tend to privatize the raising of children and put all the responsibility and or a lot of the responsibility and the financial burden on individual parents and not think of children as a public good. We do to some degree with schools, but you're right, compared to many other developed nations, we don't have universal child care in most states that goes to about three-year-olds. We don't have structures in place that make it really a choice. And so if everybody could have a meaningful choice around being able to raise children well or deciding that's not for them, it would be a different conversation.
All right, let's go to Sharon in Union. Hi, Sharon.
Hi, how are you?
Good, thanks.
Good. I really am appreciative that you're having this conversation on the air. I didn't hear the very beginning. I was in my car, but I'm calling. I don't know whether, you know, anybody's been the canary in the coal mine today, but I feel like that when I'm going to say what I'm going to say. Back in the late, I think it was the late 60s or the early 70s, it was a really groundbreaking book by Paul Ehrlich called The Population Bomb. And Mr. Ehrlich, who is very old right now, was on an NPR program not too long ago, much to my surprise. And he was putting out some statistics on the number of people that now exist in the world compared to when he wrote that book. It was something like, I don't even want to say, because it was, I can't remember the exact number, but it was vastly increased. And, you know, I think part of the conversation that couples should have, or is, and you know, maybe nobody stresses this, but we are way beyond the carrying capacity of this world. And if we aren't, you know, if we can't see that from what's going on with resources and wars and haves and have-nots, then I feel like we're really not paying attention to a really big part of this conversation, which is there are other reasons besides the rights of people to have children or not to have children to not have children.
Sure. And
my choice was when I was very influenced by that book because I grew up in the, you know, in the 60s and, or I was already an adult in the 60s, so I was reading books like that. And I just said, I don't know whether I'm going to get married or not. And as it turned out, I didn't. But that wouldn't have prevented me from having children, obviously. But I made a choice at that point that I would not have children because I didn't want to contribute to a growing and obvious problem that was taking place all over the world. Just my one little thing that I could do.
Sure. And we did bring up zero population growth. Had a person asked a couple of emails, but you're right, it's a recurring theme, and it's certainly part of the conversation.
Yep. Yeah,
so
it is.
I don't know whether young people are even aware of that book, but I would recommend that book as, you know, as reading to the current generation, because it's very, very important as to the quality of life in the future.
Right. Sharon, thanks so much. We're going to go now to Nancy on Mount Desert or Mount Desert, depending on where you're from. Hi, Nancy.
Hello. I'm calling to ask the the guests on your panel to comment on the fact that many parents choose not to have children because of adverse childhood experiences, abuse, mental illness, substance abuse, and they fear that they have no sufficient role models to provide a healthy upbringing for their children, and so they choose not to have them. And I've talked to many people of all ages who have made a decision based on that fact about their background. And probably if I had not had an unplanned pregnancy and few choices in 1965, I wouldn't have had children either, for the additional reason of the zero population growth that the last caller had talked about. So I'd like to know whether the choice sometimes has to do with hearing you're going to play that same tape over again with your own children and make the same mistakes that they did.
Any comment?
Yes. That is something that has come up in some of my interviews with child-free women and men. I will say, perhaps surprisingly, that the bigger pattern that I've found among the 50-plus people that I've interviewed is that more of them say, I had a wonderful childhood. My parents were incredible parents, are incredible parents, and I recognize how much work it takes to be a parent, and how much dedication to one's child it takes to be a good parent. So now my sample is not generalizable, so I don't want to say that this is true for all child-free people, but that theme was definitely stronger in my interviews than the other. But certainly I have spoken with people who have shared that they chose not to because of either a genetic history or their own childhood experiences.
They were afraid of passing either that gene on,
right,
or not being or not being a good role model because,
right,
of Julia, any research?
There is some. We have some preliminary evidence from again from this very large survey that more people mentioned similar concerns to what you mentioned about. Maybe wishing they had not gotten pregnant with the person they did, or wishing they hadn't been subjected to violence and then gotten pregnant. And so I don't have data specifically about how they were raised and that as a reason not to have a child. It's more about their contemporary situation. But there are people who, about 50% of pregnancies among women in the United States were unintended, and about half of those end in termination. And so there's certainly people who, for a variety of reasons, either the circumstances in which they got pregnant or other reasons, don't want to have a particular pregnancy. So it is important to consider.
We're about a minute left in the program, and I've got other calls. One person's asking about zero population again, particularly in light of climate change. And another person says, my student loan debt will prevent me from being able to afford children. These are sort of newer phenomenons or factors in the world that are adding pressure, I guess, in this case.
Right.
Amy.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
I mean, and these are things that do come up in our interviews as well.
Yeah. All right. With that, we're out of time. I appreciate both of you being here. Really interesting conversation.
Thank you.
Amy
Thank
Blackstone,
you.
Professor of Sociology at the University of Maine, Orono. She and her husband run the blog We're Not Having a Baby. And Julia McQuillan joined us from the University of Nebraska-Lincoln, where she's professor and department chair of sociology. Jonathan Woodward
Thank
ran
you.
The board today. Our volunteer Cindy Hahn answered your calls. And volunteer Tommy Bazarian produced today's program. And, of course, the executive producer of Maine Calling is Jonathan Smith. Tomorrow on the program, Lions Club, Rotary Club, Junior League. These are just a few of the service organizations in our state. Join Jennifer Rooks for a conversation about the role and future of these organizations in Maine. I'm Keith Shortall. You've been listening to Maine Calling on the Maine Public Broadcasting Network.
You make Maine Calling possible, as do the law offices of Joe Bornstein. Over 65 professionals representing injured and disabled Mainers statewide. JoeBornstein.com.
On the next Diane Rehm Show, a new report from the Federal Reserve says student loan debt now surpasses what people owe on their cars and credit cards, ballooning student debt, and what the presidential candidates are saying about soaring college costs.
That's coming up on the Diane Rehm Show today at 2 o'clock here on MPBN Radio. MPBN, both radio and television, broadcast BBC News as part of our schedule. The comprehensive global reach of the BBC's coverage and the diverse viewpoints and perspectives their coverage represents complements our overall news coverage here at MPBN. MPBN Television has two daily weekday broadcasts, 6 in the morning and at 6 in the evening. And here on MPBN Radio, you can hear the BBC overnights from 1 to 6 a.m. and as part of Morning Edition during the 8 o'clock hour. You can also link directly to the BBC on our website, mpbn.net. You are listening to the Maine Public Broadcasting Network. We are WMEH in Bangor, 90.9, WMEA in Portland on 90.1, WMEP in Camden on 90.5, WMEM in Presque Isle on 106.1, WMED Calais on 89.7, WMEW Waterville 91.3, WMEF in Fort Kent on 106.5, and we're online at mpbn.net. Stay tuned. The Commonwealth Club of California is next. Community support is what makes public affairs programming possible, together with Mid-Maine Restoration, specializing in steeple and tower restoration throughout Maine and New Hampshire for over 25 years. Maine-steeplejacks.com. And Freemasons in Maine, supporting Maine Public Broadcasting's efforts to provide knowledge, wisdom, and entertainment to the people of Maine. The time now is 1 o'clock.